the government hasn't been able to openly trade with Israel, you know, with like great open fanfare. Things are happening in a clandestine way. And I think that is very interesting and important, that even a country like India is sort of held back by the BRICS consensus. I've never, ever said the BRICS is like the future of the world, okay? But it is an opening. And I want to just register this, that within the BRICS countries, they continue to take this position. And it's really important that right through this conflict, both India and China have said that the two-state solution must not be annulled. Now, I know, David, that you know, you've probably had lots of people on the program criticizing the two-state solution. I also think the two-state solution on the ground has been basically annulled. But it's still important for major powers in the world to hold fast to the two-state solution, because if you say that the two-state solution is done, then the Israelis can annex East Jerusalem, West Bank, and Gaza without any resistance. Right now, when China says the two-state solution must be respected, what they are saying is you cannot annex Gaza, you cannot annex the West Bank. So we need to understand these things diplomatically and contextually. You know, in context, the two-state solution is not realistic and viable, but when they are saying it, it's about an anti-annexation view, which I think is very important to maintain. And I think even though these voices of conscience in Israel say the same thing, they are also saying don't annex Gaza, their ability to actually reach large numbers of people is hampered. You know, it's much restricted. Whereas, you know, when the Chinese government says it, it has an impact because it then influences the Indian foreign ministry, the South African foreign ministry, and so on. You know, everybody then repeats that. And I think that's very significant because they are not going to permit the annexation, or at least they are not, they're going to try their best not to.
You're listening to Vijay Prashad. Is the Nakba permanent? This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. October 7th. No context for it or other Palestinian attacks. The occupation and annexationist policies are never mentioned. To explain and give background in history is not to condone acts of violence. For example, it might be helpful for people to know that Gaza has been under an Israeli blockade since 2007, or that many thousands of Palestinians are in jail, held without charges, or that demolition of homes is collective punishment, or that there are now more than 750,000 settlers in the West Bank. So this goes to the heart of what is called media coverage or lack of coverage.
Everybody must feel for civilians. You know, civilians, when they are taken, whether as hostages or whatnot, it's a very scary thing and it shouldn't happen to anybody. But I also want to emphasize that in a way, all of Gaza is under hostage situation. You know, people just can't go anywhere. They can't travel. They can barely get anything. They are within a kind of large prison compound. Even though Palestinians have built a lot of joy inside Gaza before the bombardment, it's still an enclosed space. Part of Oslo II was to allow the Palestinians of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza free access to each other. That was never permitted. You know, there's no free access for the Palestinians in the occupied territories. Obviously, these forms of violence or these forms of fighting are going to take place. A few years ago, the Palestinians attempted a peaceful march to the perimeter fence. They were slaughtered. You know, that annuls peaceful protests. Then you think, why should we do peace? Why should we be, you know, fish in a bucket? We're going to now go and get hostages. I mean, I can see the logic of this. It's not illogical. If you look at how those peaceful marchers were sniped and killed and the eyes taken out and so on, it does leave you with an idea that this nonviolent strategy is not going to work. You know, people who say, why don't the Palestinians do something nonviolent? Well, every time they've tried a nonviolent something, they've been brutally attacked. So you try something like this.
Now, again, to Nakba then and now. In Gaza, people are starving to death, says Oxfam. Save the Children says every child is now at risk of famine. Marco Rubio, who spends a lot of time chasing students who say things that he doesn't like, commanded by his president, he has said that the U.S. is, quote, troubled by the humanitarian situation in Gaza. How about that? Troubled. Asked by the BBC if the Trump administration remained fully behind the nature of Israel's military action, he once again called on Hamas to surrender and release hostages and said there could be no peace so long as the group exists. What do you think about our esteemed Secretary of State and his saying that he's troubled by the deaths of tens of thousands and the wounding of many more and the destruction that has been wreaked?
Now, I'm glad that Mr. Rubio, or Secretary Rubio, has made the comment saying that he's concerned. And I think we should take what we get. I mean, I'm actually very happy to hear that he is concerned, which means that there is some humanity in him, and I'd like to appeal to that humanity. And I would like to say to him that, look, you say the people of Gaza, but at least you can name them. They are Palestinians. That would be helpful, that they are Palestinian people and that they have been struggling actually to exercise their humanity. And also that Hamas is merely one of many resistance factions that are trying to defend and assist the Palestinians to attain freedom. They're not the only one. You know, Mr. Netanyahu well knows that if Hamas is destroyed today, another group is going to appear tomorrow. You know, they weakened Fatah. They weakened Fatah deeply, and the space was filled by Hamas. You know, Hamas weakened now, the space will be filled by somebody else. Years ago, while he was walking on his treadmill, Khalid Mishal gave an interview where he said that, look, if you think Hamas is a dangerous organization, you don't know what's coming next. You know, what he meant was that these cycles of violence produce their opposition. You know, and a cycle of submission also produces its opposition. You know, right now, the Kurdish Workers' Party has decided to end its armed struggle, in front of the Turkish state. They have decided the PKK, the armed struggle is over. But now the onus is on the Turkish state. Will they accept the Kurds as full-fledged citizens of Turkey? Will they allow the Kurdish language to be spoken? Will they no longer discriminate against the 1 million Kurds who work and live in Istanbul, more than 1 million? If they don't do that, a new PKK will emerge. You know, it's not that the PKK was some residue of the past. It's actually it's a condition of the present. You know, the reason why the FARC, the revolutionary armed group in Colombia, decided to set down weapons at the Havana Agreement was because they anticipated and saw a political way forward. They now have a political party in Colombia called Commune, and they feel like the current government of Gustavo Petro is taking some of the questions of land reform pretty seriously. So they decided to end the armed struggle. I mean, there are plenty of examples of armed struggles ending. But the armed struggle by Hamas or by the Palestinians is only going to end when the occupation of the Palestinian ends. That's it. They are not going to surrender before the occupation ends. And so that is something that the Israelis are well aware of. It's not rocket science. And all the examples of a proper ending of an armed struggle is either when the armed struggle prevails. That's the example of the Chinese Revolution in 1949 or the Cuban Revolution of 1959. Or if the armed struggle is destroyed completely, that's the example of Guatemala, for instance, where the armed struggle was completely destroyed, or where the armed struggle ends because the ruling elites decide to incorporate the demands of the armed struggle and then there's a peaceful transfer. Example there, again, being Colombia, 2008, to some extent being Nepal, where the armed struggle morphs, allows political parties to develop. And let's see what happens in Turkey. We don't know. The announcement has just come. So there is no evidence in world history of an armed struggle, let's say the Palestinian struggle, being shut down because a big power has told them to stop doing it. It would effectively, in the conditions right now, be a surrender. I don't think the Palestinians are willing to surrender.
Respond, if you can decode a couple of mantras that Israeli officials intone time and time again. One is that, yes, there are civilian casualties among the Palestinians. That's because Hamas is using them as human shields. That's certainly one common trope. Another one is that any country that is attacked has the right to self-defense.
Yeah, let's take the second one first, that any country that's attacked has the right to self-defense. That's actually true. Any country that's attacked by international law has the right to self-defense. There's no question about that. That's absolutely true. The only difference is that Israel is a country, but it's not being attacked by another country. And that's a key factor. If Israel was attacked by, let's say, Syria, or if Israel was attacked by Jordan, then Israel has a right to defend itself. But when you are occupying a people, when you have a military occupation of a people, in fact, it is not your self-defense that's paramount, but the paramount international obligation is that the people who are being occupied have the right to fight with any means against the occupation to end the occupation. So, in fact, the prior right is not with Israel. The prior right is with the occupied party, which has a right to defend itself against the occupation by any means. So, in fact, what the Israelis say in abstraction is correct, that a country has a right to defend itself. But when it comes to the specific situation of the Palestinians and Israelis, the prior right is not with the Israelis. The prior right is with the Palestinians, who have a right by any means to fight against their occupation. So that's the second statement. The first is actually quite interesting. And Gaza is a super congested area when you look at the cities. So you could sit in a rural part of Gaza and fire rockets, but then you're a sitting duck. You know, if you enter a city and attempt to do guerrilla warfare from Gaza City or from Khan Yunis, there is no space there for you to create a military zone, you know, from which to fire. And in fact, the Israelis are completely hypocritical about this, because in Tel Aviv, they've built their Shin Bet headquarters, their military headquarters, in the middle of residential areas. So when Hezbollah fires rockets at them, they say, oh my God, you've hit a civilian area. They built purposefully, I think, these headquarters in civilian areas. Also, I would grant that in Israel, a very congested society, you may have built something in a slightly remote area and housing has crept in. You know what our cultures are like. There are housing laws and nobody listens to them and they just keep building. They bribe some lower official. Next thing you learn, there's a protected military zone and there's a big multi-story building overlooking it, you know, and looking into the military base, which is a protected zone. This has happened. I've seen it in Haryana. Anyway, there is no way for Palestinians to fire things into Israel or to live anywhere or to hide anywhere without being surrounded by civilians. To say that the Palestinian fighters are using civilians as shields is, I think, ludicrous, if you understand what Gaza is like. Secondly, these statements that they are building tunnels under hospitals and so on has been proven to be ridiculous. I mean, the show of cameras going underneath the hospital and showing whatever tunnel. I mean, it didn't prove anything. It didn't prove that there was military arsenal there. In fact, the Israelis now are bombing makeshift hospitals almost deliberately. I mean, I don't know. I can't say deliberately, because I don't get their statement saying we are going to bomb a hospital. The evidence suggests that they are deliberately bombing residences and hospitals and schools and universities. Why did the Israelis, having captured sections of Gaza City, then put explosives on the university, on Gaza, the Islamic University of Gaza, and demolish it. Why? They were right there. They could have gone down, checked tunnels, whatever. No, they deliberately demolished the university. That, to me, is academicide. You know, that kind of thing is open, and they filmed it and celebrated it. Using Palestinians as human shields, I don't think that sits well with me. It's not true. I don't think they are deliberately saying we are willing to sacrifice, you know, our people in order for some, you know, hiding behind. I mean, these are pretty courageous people.
The political landscape in the Middle East has dramatically changed. Trump went on a sales trip to those great democracies, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. Israel has seemingly, and I'm qualifying that, seemingly emerged as the regional hegemonic power. It has smashed Hamas, it routed Hezbollah in Lebanon, it weakened Iran. The fall of the Assad regime in Syria in December was a huge blow to Iran. Israel continues to occupy and bomb parts of Syria and Lebanon. It bombs in retaliation the Houthis in Yemen. U.S. sanctions on Syria have been lifted. And as you mentioned, after some 40 years, the PKK, the Kurdish movement, has given up armed struggle against the Turkish state. So what are your views on this seemingly changed landscape?
This seemingly changed landscape has been changing for a long time. I don't think we should see it as an immediate thing. I mean, we've got to go back to the first biggest blow, biggest change in the Middle East that occurred, which occurred in 1979, and that was Camp David, when the Egyptians decided to sign a peace agreement with the Israelis. That was the first break, I think, amongst the regional countries vis-a-vis what Israel had achieved in 1948. I mean, people need to recognize that the British, firstly, when they left both the Levant area, the British mandate in the Levant, and when they left the British Raj in India, they very callously left by trying to partition the areas and just leave it at that. I mean, in British India, the partition of the subcontinent, the Radcliffe lines, resulted in the death of 1 million people at least, and 13 million people were displaced, including my family, displaced from Lahore into northern India and so on. I mean, this was a catastrophe of its own kind. 1 million people died. I mean, I just don't think people around the world know that how this devastation occurred. The birth of India and Pakistan was traumatic. Both countries went into a war in 1948. The same was in the Levant. I mean, the British just sort of made a line in the sand and said, this is the partition. This is going to be Palestine. This is going to be the new Jewish state. And this is our British settlement over the mandate as we leave. And of course, the Israelis didn't honor the British partition, and they seized everything except roughly 20% or so that was Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. That's because the Jordanian armies had come and taken the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and the Egyptians came and took Gaza. And that's where the refugees were settled, except those that went outside the region or went to Jordan and Lebanon. So these are twin processes of the harm that British imperialism has done in both the subcontinent and in the Levant region, in Palestine. So this is a completely different story of displacement, of anger, and so on. And this then magnified over the years, you know, as one, two, three generations, four, five generations don't get justice. It magnified over the years the sense of deep injustice. And the roots of that deep injustice never went away. You know, at a certain point, the Fatah group in the Palestinian Liberation Organization said, okay, we'll just take the 20-odd percent that was left, the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. Even that was not acceptable. The Israelis built settlements. They simply didn't allow and honor Oslo II, which was really a surrender. It's what Edward Said called the Palestinian Versailles, a surrender. They never even accepted that. They wanted everything. They kept talking about Judea and Samaria. They wouldn't even accept a word called Palestinian. They said even that doesn't exist, you know. So this particular genocidal act against the Palestinians is really just a qualitative increase in violence to get the Palestinians out of Palestine.
Years ago, Arundhati Roy, the great Indian writer, said, "Another world is possible." I haven't talked with her recently. I wonder if she still feels optimistic, given the genocide in Gaza, mass killings in Sudan, the Congo, and Myanmar, to terminal war dangers in South Asia, to a planet getting hotter and hotter, and extreme weather events become more and more frequent. How do we get to a more peaceful world?
Oh, I love Arundhati. I love her writings. I love her as a person. I don't agree with that slogan. I didn't agree then. I don't agree now. Because it's a non-specific slogan. Of course, another world is possible. Even fascism is possible. You know, anything is possible. I don't agree. It's too non-specific. The real slogan is socialism is necessary, David. That, for me, is the real slogan. It's not another. It's socialism is necessary. I mean, the capitalist system has shown itself to be brutal, have utter disregard for humanity and for nature. Let's just pack it in and let capitalism ruin everything. You know, let's allow Elon Musk to blow the world up and fly off to Mars as he watches in the rearview mirror a big convulsion happening here. Okay, let's give it up. I don't agree. I think we fight it. And we fight it not to build a better, more humane capitalism, because I don't think that's possible. I think we fight it to build socialism. I might be a romantic idiot or whatever. Somebody may want to call me out of touch with reality. I don't care. All signs show that this system cannot solve itself. All signs show that. There's hundreds of millions of people around the world who are aching for something different. We have to give them something specific, a utopia. Call it whatever you will. You don't want to call it socialism? Fine. Call it whatever you will. We need to build another world where people are able to live with dignity and they are able to live with nature, taking some of the fruits of nature but not destroying nature. That's what we need. I call that socialism. You can call it whatever you want. It's the same thing. We need to get out of this. Elon Musk cannot be allowed to blow this up. We need to build something that is better, and I call that socialism. So I say socialism is necessary.
Finally, what gives you hope? What keeps you going?
I mean, look, partly it's kind of stubbornness, you know. I mean, just can't give it up, you know. It's going to get better. It's partly that. It's partly every single poet I've ever read. You know, poetry, even the bleakest poetry, always has some sort of horizon, you know, where there's some light shining somewhere. Faiz Ahmed Faiz, our great, star in the sky, Faiz Ahmed Faiz, you know, wrote poetry in prison, which is, you know, says that the door will always open, you know, the cage will always open. And I breathe that every day. You know, I believe that the door will open, the cage will open. You can't live like this forever. The human spirit, and I believe there's such a thing, the human spirit cannot be exhausted. You know, it continues to flourish. Look at Leonard Peltier, so many years illegally in jail, walks out, breathes the air and says beautiful things. He's not bitter. He's not angry. He's looking forward to building a new world. Take inspiration from those stories, David. People who continue to feel that part of the human spirit that just cannot be exhausted.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks a lot, David.
You were just listening to Vijay Prashad, Is the Nakba Permanent? I talked with him in mid-May. Vijay Prashad is an internationally renowned historian and journalist. He's the author of many books, including Washington Bullets, CIA Coups and Assassinations. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Chris Hedges, Naomi Klein, Gabor Mate, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Noam Chomsky. And we have a series of Vijay Prashad programs. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Vijay Prashad is the Nakba Permanent, and for Vijay Prashad's classic book, Washington Bullets, CIA Coups and Assassinations, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to KGNU. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Indian sitar maestro Vilayat Khan performing Raga Sohini.
Ha huagestig ri CGSF, nached poing aun FM, Crowley vo Burnaby, British Columbia.
From coast to coast.